Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 25th of April. Our guest this hour says that true individual freedom depends on the existence of a robust state that is dedicated to the public interest. If we don't have a healthy state, humans naturally tend to create legal structures that are centered not on individuals, but rather on extended family groups. Our guest this hour is the author of The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom. Mark Wiener teaches constitutional law and legal history at the Rutgers School of Law in Newark, New Jersey. He's the author of other books, including Black Trials, Citizenship from the Beginning of Slavery to the End of Caste. And he invites in his new book readers to engage in what might seem to be, he says, a contradictory exercise to consider what societies governed by the rule of the clan can teach citizens of modern liberal democracies. By examining the rule of the clan and understanding its legal and cultural architecture, including its many positive and compelling features, liberals can gain critical insights for liberalism. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Mark is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, we'd like to hear from you, is Talk is the Kathleen Dunn Show. That is the Facebook page. Mark Wiener, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's start with the individualist focus, which you say really is fundamental to the law of modern liberal society. Tell me more about that focus.
Sure. There are all kinds of ways in which the fundamental principles of our legal order serve to maximize individual freedom, and they're concerned not with the status or the persistence or the health of collective groups, such as the extended family group that I call the clan, but instead with individual autonomy. So, for instance, when you hold title to real property, to land, you hold it in your own name rather than in the name of your family. If take criminal law. If you do the crime, you, if you're caught, will do the time, rather than, say, a cousin of yours or a brother who might be subject to collective retribution on the part of a family member of the victim of the crime. So there are all kinds of ways in which our social and legal order serves to maximize individual freedom. And it does that through the existence of healthy, robust government. We tend to think that, in some ways, government is the enemy of individual freedom. But in fact, if we look at this ancient form of social organization, we see that effective government is its individual freedom's precondition.
Where did we get, because it is a widespread view among many, as you well know, the belief that individual freedom exists only when the state is frail?
Absolutely, and I held that view for a long time as well. It's a major part of the liberal political tradition that we have in the United States, and it's a good one, to be suspicious and seek to limit state power. But we can take that impulse too far, because when the state goes frail and weak, other collective groups fill that vacuum of power, and they impose social and legal order based not on principles of individualism, but out of concern for the collective bottom line.
What does it mean, and give us examples from the many times in history and places on this planet that you studied this, for a society to be governed by the rule of clan?
Yes, well, the rule of the clan, it's a name that I give to a form of social and legal organization that takes as its center concern the health and stability of the extended family group. A clan is just an extended family membership circle, or you can think of it as a subset of a tribe. Though I use the term not only in that technical sense, but also as a metaphor for a range of corporate and collective groups that maintain social and legal order when the state is weak or absent. The classic example that many people in the United States will know is the clan life of the Scott Highlanders. And this is a world, or this was a world, very similar to a whole variety of other clan societies that I examine in the group, that's centered on high social solidarity within an extended family group, often held together by principles of group honor and shame, highly decentralized in constitutional terms. Dispute resolution is undertaken by traditional clan elders, often lying behind that dispute resolution is the threat of a blood feud. And there are high levels of social solidarity that those kind of societies can provide. So the Scott Highlanders would be the classic example of that kind of society. And indeed, we get our very term clan, which we use today to apply to all kinds of unstable and often dangerous parts of the world, from Gaelic.
Oh, that's interesting. When we think of clan now, I think many of us think of Afghanistan, Somalia, Nigeria.
Yeah, precisely right. And in fact, the book for me came out of thinking about those societies. I was spending a semester in northern Iceland. I was teaching constitutional law there in a little law school that very improbably exists right snug up against the Arctic Circle. And as I was thinking about the history of Icelandic society, which in the Middle Ages was organized along clan lines that are not dissimilar from the societies that you mentioned, I was also thinking about Afghanistan and Iraq, because many of my students had either fought there or were fighting there at the moment. And at a certain point, a kind of electric current jumped between, for me, medieval Iceland, the modern United States, and Afghanistan and Iraq, and that's how the book was born.
Mm. So what was it like to be teaching in Iceland?
It was cold and dark, but very, very interesting. At the time, Icelanders were in the midst of their financial crisis, and they were beginning to think about reforming their own constitution. And I had the opportunity to teach about American constitutionalism to Icelanders at just that moment. So it was very stimulating. And it was very stimulating to think about the history of the Icelandic Middle Ages. Iceland in the Middle Ages was unique in European history because the settlers to that country left Norway in order to flee the what we now call the political development that was occurring there at the time, namely the development of a more centralized kingship. Some of your viewers may have seen that there was an interesting documentary about the Vikings recently. I think it was on HBO. That depicts this quite well. In any case, the Icelanders flee the political development of centralizing kingship, and they establish a society that has a very sophisticated legislature, that has a very sophisticated system of courts, but that has absolutely no executive authority. Hmm. There was no central authority to actually enforce law, which meant that legal enforcement was privatized, and therefore that extended family membership and kinship of all sorts was essential to actually making the law work.
Hmm. So how did that play out? What did kinship do to make the law work?
Well, what it meant is if you had a legal judgment in your favor, in order to actually enforce that judgment, if someone was unwilling to comply with a court's judgment, a court's order, you would gather all of your family and your friends and arm yourself to the teeth with weapons and persuade people that the judgment ought to be followed. But it meant something else as well, and that is that in medieval Iceland, as in modern Afghanistan or Iraq or Somalia or Nigeria, criminal law functioned under the principle of, or what we today call criminal law, or the law of personal injury, functioned under the principle of collective liability. Very interesting. So as I said earlier, in modern liberal criminal justice systems, if you do some crime, let's say you, God forbid, you kill someone, you're then subject to the punishment meted out by the state, and they'll put you in prison. But in clan societies like medieval Iceland or modern Afghanistan, especially among the most traditional parts of modern Afghanistan, you can be punished by the family members of a victim who's been hurt not by you personally, but, say, by your brother or by a cousin. Mm-hmm. Societies operate under principles of collective liability.
Mm. You also look in part of the book at contemporary Palestinian authority, where you say that the rule of the clan and a weak state exist side by side. And so the outcome of that is what?
Corruption. So the rule of the clan exists, you can think of the rule of the clan as existing along a continuum from the most traditional stateless tribal societies to even modern, within modern liberal democracies. There are areas of even our own country where the writ of the state doesn't fully run effectively. Let's say many American inner cities. There you find other forms of collective organizations rising up to take the place of the state, criminal gangs. Somewhere in between modern liberal democracies and stateless societies is a group of societies that are governed by what the Arab Human Development Report of 2004 calls clanism. This is basically a political order in which there's a nascent developing state, so it's not a stateless society like traditional tribal societies, but that state has been captured by various kin groups, and at the same time, the state looks to its own citizens on the model of the traditional patriarchal family, in which persons aren't really citizens with rights, but rather troublesome dependents to be managed. So what we have in societies that are governed by clanism is a state that doles out favors on the basis of collective group membership, that's what we commonly call corruption, and at the same time looks at its citizens in a kind of managerial sense.
Mm-hmm. You also, well, you look at so much in the book, but you highlight two, you call them seemingly different medieval societies, Anglo-Saxon England and early Islamic Arabia.
Yes. So I think that, well, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is engage in a dialogue between the Western and Islamic political traditions and traditions of social thought. And both Anglo-Saxon England and early Islamic Arabia were, in different, though related senses, clan societies, and they had to overcome the rule of the clan in order to engage in the social and governmental development that characterized those societies at around the same time in history, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries. And so there's very interesting parallels between the early Islamic political tradition and the political tradition of early Anglo-Saxon England.
Hmm. So how do you overcome the rule of the clan? What would prompt that, and how is it accomplished?
Well, there are many different examples from history from which we can generalize. You can imagine the rule of the clan being overcome in two senses, from above and from below. And probably the most important critical development in the transition from the rule of the clan to the rule of law is the formation of a common identity across kinship or across clan lines, in which people come to have a sense of themselves as belonging to a common group that's even more important than their family membership. That happened in Anglo-Saxon England and in early Islamic Arabia, especially through the influence of religion, through Christianity and Islam. But there are other ways that it can happen as well. We saw, for instance, recently, fortunately, that Kenyans, in their recent election, were able to overcome the terrible violence, or to avoid the terrible violence that had so plagued the previous election. And one of the reasons that they were able to do that is that middle-class people mobilized into a One Kenya movement that sought to enable people to see their commonalities among their beyond their clan and tribal affiliations.
Mm. This hour of our program, we're talking with the author of The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom. Mark Wiener is our guest, and Mark teaches constitutional law and legal history at the Rutgers School of Law. We're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We go to Nancy in Madison for our first caller. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I'd like to know if the guest considers the structure of the mafia and other related groups in southern Italy and Sicily to be an example of the clan structure he's talking about, and how it happens that they can then, how they then can transport that structure into a whole different culture, such as the United States.
This is a terrific question, Nancy. Thanks so much. Indeed, I do, and I mentioned the mafia just a little bit in the book as an example of the kind of organization that can develop within liberal societies that functions a great deal and looks a great deal like ancient clans and poses some of the same challenges to the maintenance of the liberal rule of law. The mafia is, in its most traditional sense, an organization that's structured along family lines. It has a central to it principles of honor and shame, group honor and shame, collective liability, feuding, all of the things that we were talking about earlier. So, absolutely, we need to be concerned within liberal societies about groups like the mafia or other international crime syndicates that can grow when the state's authority begins to waver or shake. Think about the international crime syndicates in Mexico. How is it possible to import a group like the mafia into other societies in which... Oh, hello?
No, she's listening on the radio.
Very good. Hi, Nancy. So how is it possible to import a group like the mafia into or a group like the mafia into other societies where, and I take this to be the implication of Nancy's question, where those traditional family structures don't exist? They do so by creating new networks of what anthropologists call fictive kinship. So other groups are incorporated into the original family group symbolically.
Hmm. You also write, and let's take it to this level for a moment, today you say corporate conglomerates and collectivist identity groups have the potential to transform into clan-like systems.
Yeah, I think that today, it's often said that in the United States we are threatened by rampant individualism. And from a moral and cultural perspective, that may be the case. But I think from a political and legal perspective, exactly the opposite is true. That is that in the face of the possibility that the state will diminish in authority, will weaken, will even grow anemic, a whole variety of other, call them postmodern clans, can take the place of the state. And rather than enforcing social order and principles on the basis of both the public interest and individualism, they'll impose social order on the basis of their collective needs. And the most concerning such group for me, in my eyes, is the modern American corporation, that is, and the transnational corporation. Is it possible? Do we need to be concerned? I think we do, that such collective corporate groups can take the place of the state and in doing so undermine the fundamental values of individualism that our society is dedicated to. Mm.
And how have they taken the place of the state? How so?
So when state regulatory authority diminishes, in the face of that diminished authority, corporations have an inborn tendency, indeed an incentive, to monopolize their power. And then in the presence of that monopolized corporate power, corporations, private groups, think back to medieval Iceland, private groups begin to discharge a whole variety of goods or a whole variety of functions that previously were provided by the state. And that's how it happens. Hmm.
We welcome more phone calls in just one moment. As you can tell, we have a lot on our plate this morning. It's fascinating. Mark Wiener is our guest. His new book is The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Thursday, Michael Pollan will be joining us. Michael has a new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And he writes that cooking is really a very, very important thing. It's one of the most interesting and worthwhile things that we humans do, as long as we let corporations do most of our cooking for us. Our agriculture will continue to be dominated by giant monocultures of grain and animal factories. Big companies only know how to buy from big farms, and it means the movement to build local agriculture can develop only so far unless people are willing to buy from those farms. And in order to buy from those farms, they have to cook. He'll be fascinating. That's hour two of our show. This hour, Mark Wiener is with us, and Mark is a constitutional law professor and legal history professor at the Rutgers School of Law. His book is The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom. We go to more of your phone calls. Rich in Rhinelander is next. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, guests. Thanks. This past winter, the fellowship I belong to up here read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration and the Age of Colorblindness. And your guest's commentary puts me in mind of the idea that when you create certain kinds of repressive laws, as we did during Prohibition, and which we now have during the war on drugs, in which drug usage has not really risen, but spending on the war on drugs has risen to something like $1.8 trillion over, you know, a 30, 40-year period, that you get elements of interest in a society and law enforcement that lead to really a kind of persecution of certain minorities within society. And you see the same thing going on in terms of, or a somewhat similar thing going on in terms of recent assassinations of court officials at their doorsteps by white Aryan Nation kind of gangs in governing from within prison, it's believed. I'm wondering if this fits with your guest idea of medievalism, that what's happening in Mexico with the drug war is what he's talking about. And at a certain level in our country, this is also happening with our war on drugs, both on the law enforcement side and on what is purported to be the criminal side, the purveyors of drugs.
Oh, interesting comments.
Rich, thanks for your comment. Very interesting. Of course, when the war on drugs began, I think anyone who understood the consequences of the policy knew that it would result in generations of African American men being put in prison. It's a terrible, misguided set of policies that we've undertaken, and I generally oppose it or think it could have been done much better and more effectively. Certainly, we need to be absolutely on guard of any way in which the state, the modern liberal state, can be overtaken by corruption or, in the caller Rich refers to the recent assassinations of law enforcement officials, any form of racialist principle that will undermine the essential individualism of the liberal state. So we need to make sure to defend liberal principles of individual freedom, not simply that we have a strong, effective, and robust government, but that we have good government that is transparent and efficient and free from corruption. And only by doing that, only by looking to ourselves and ensuring that our own governments live up to the ideals of the liberal enlightenment, can we offer a model, can we even purport to offer a model to liberals elsewhere in the world who are seeking to reform their own societies to overcome the rule of the Klan.
Thank you very much, Rich, for your interesting call. Let's go to Lori next in Hills Corners. Hi, Lori.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I feel pretty passionate about this. It seems to me that we have another elephant in the room now, and it has to do with corporate power and money in government. And don't you think, is there something we can learn from what you're talking about that applies to this situation and what we need to do?
100%. So I think that corporations, modern transnational corporations, pose as great a threat to individual freedom as ancient clans. That is, that modern corporations threaten, in some sense, to become the new clans for us and to impose, to create, to structure our societies along collectivist lines in the same way that ancient tribal organization did. And so I think that if we look back to societies in the past that have been governed by the rule of the Klan, or to societies today that are governed by the rule of the Klan or Klanism, what we can learn is how critical it is to maintain effective government that can keep these collectivist forces at bay. In some ways, liberals everywhere across the world are engaged in a common struggle. So we can make common cause as liberals, by which I don't mean that in a partisan political sense, as Democrats versus Republicans. I mean people dedicated to principles of individual freedom, tolerance, all of the values that come out of especially the 19th century variety of the liberal enlightenment. People who are dedicated to liberal political values in the United States, who are working to restrict corporate power, ought to and can make common cause with liberals, say, in Pakistan or in the tribal areas of Pakistan, who are seeking to reform their own societies to overcome the authority of collective clan groups. Mm. We're engaged in a common struggle as people dedicated to individual freedom. I should say, and that struggle is to build an effective state that can vindicate individual freedom by vindicating the public interest at large.
Mm. I'd like for you to comment, because I think that there is a lot in your book that is relevant to what we're going through as a nation right now. We really get totally thrown for a loop and afraid of individual freedom, and we're not very tolerant when we have an event take place such as what happened in Boston last week. What kind of threat is that to a liberal state? What have you learned through history that we need to guard against, and what would be kind of a common response to a threat?
Well, the terrible events in Boston, I think, raise for us, or ought to raise for us, two issues. The first is, how do we go about the prosecution of individuals who are dedicated, so it seems, to sowing terror in ways that maintain the principles of individual rights on which our country is founded and to which we're dedicated? That is, how can we undertake not only these prosecutions, but in general our, whatever you'd like to call it the war on terror, in a way that is consistent with liberal democratic principles? First concern that we need to bear in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, I think that the many nations that are governed by some form of the rule of the clan or by clanism are in parts of the world that are traditional or have recently been generators of this minority of terrorist militants. And we need to be really concerned to advance liberal social and political development in those societies, which can so often provide safe havens for enemies of modern liberal democracies.
Hmm.
Now, I should say, a lot is going to come out in the future about these two brothers, but certainly Chechen society is traditionally based on the kind of clan ties and structure very much like what I describe in the book, though I don't talk about the Caucasus in my book. That is, it's been a society of extended family groups that are formed into federations, traditional dispute resolution by elders, threat of the blood feud, high levels of social solidarity. That's why some people have regularly compared Chechen society to that of the ancient Scot Highlanders. But the Russian wars in the 90s disrupted some of these traditional clan ties. In the vacuum of authority that was created, partly facilitated the growth of the Salafist militant Islam that saw the conflict there not so much in nationalist terms, but in terms of global jihad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to attend to what happens in societies that are undergoing this social and political modernization as the old clan structures break down and make sure that it happens in a way that is consistent with liberal democratic principles and interests. You know, young men who are in societies like these that are modernizing and who then immigrate to modern liberal democracies, they undergo in their own lifetime a social and political transformation that within their societies will take 100 years to accomplish.
Hmm. And yet, when you say that, it's exactly what some people were saying after September 11th. We haven't done a very good job, have we, of doing the very thing that you suggested needed to be done.
That is attending to the role of clans
right.
Elsewhere in the world. Of course, yeah, and I also was quite surprised in the wake of September 11th, the failure to understand, it, both in political and military terms, the role of extended family membership in the societies where we, the United States, were fighting was really quite striking. And so in a way, if we think about the rule of the clan, we tend to get things wrong on both sides of the equation, both here in the United States, when we're concerned about, say, the rise of corporate power that is facilitated by an undermining of the liberal state, and abroad, when we look to tribal societies that were trying to stabilize and encourage their political development.
Mm-hmm. Lori, thanks for your call. We go to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
Well, I was really glad to hear you start talking about corporate power, because all week long, ever since the bombings and everybody's fear and reaction and the whole scene, I've been thinking about, my reaction was, yes, this is terrible, but it's not what's really threatening us all the time, because I couldn't help but think, I pay a lot of attention to all these corporate accidents in which people are killed and their health is threatened, and it happens all the time. And it's because corporations don't have a value on safety and human lives. Even they put the profits over human lives, and they don't take safety precautions. And I, you know, I made this list. I have 8 things on here that happened recently.
Hmm.
And
thinking West Texas, among others.
Yeah, West Texas. And, you know, I heard on NPR that, and I never heard it again, but that they didn't have a permit for the ammonia and they hadn't been investigated by OSHA since the 80s. I never heard that again, so I don't know about that. But there's all these other things, like the mine accidents in Kentucky. A few weeks ago, there was oil spills in people's backyard in Missouri. And
how about garment
oil spill, of course, Aaron Brockovich, that whole thing. But, I mean, it goes on and on.
Yeah, garment workers in India, another horrendous story.
Oh, terrible. I think Sarah makes a great point. And we have witnessed over the course of the past week or so, can our difficulty in thinking through the role of government and the role of clans linked on both sides of the equation, both abroad and at home. And the tragedy in West Texas seems, I hesitate to speak about it in detail as evidence emerges, but to the extent that it was facilitated by either a lack of or a lack of effective government oversight or oversight from a confused government oversight. Certainly it is the evidence of the need for effective, robust government authority that prevents not simply terrible tragedies like that in West Texas or the other tragedies that you mentioned, terrible mine accidents, but that is also essential in vindicating the very idea of the individual, because effective liberal government protects you not because you're a member of a particular family, not because you're a member of a particular tribal group, but instead simply because you are an individual citizen as such.
Thank you, Sarah, very much for your call. We'll continue taking phone calls in just a moment. Our guest is Mark Wiener. He's the author of The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom. He is a constitutional law and legal history professor at the Rutgers School of Law. And we're welcoming phone calls. We have lines open. They've been pretty crowded, so feel free to call us now if you'd like to do that. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd care to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Thursday, Michael Pollan will be joining us, author of, well, a number of books. The Omnivore's Dilemma was a big bestseller for him. All of his books have been. His latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And it's an intricate book, as most of his books are. It takes on cooking as a political act and how, in order for us to be healthy and always healthy, our bodies healthy and healthy as families, we really need to cook. So that's hour two. Mark Wiener is with us now. His book is The Rule of the Clan, and we go back to phone calls for him. Charles in Ingleside, Illinois, is next. Hi, Charles.
Well, good morning, Kathleen.
Hey, Charles.
You have a wonderful guest. Maybe as an answer to my problem, in towns like Connecticut and Massachusetts, the people are the corporate board of that town, and they control every office and the budgets of every office they vote for, down to the penny, what they have next year. Now, here you have the corporate individuals voting, controlling their town. I admire Afghanistan. They live on the land, actually, and I love the family, too. But here...
Charles? All right, his phone disappeared, but I think you get the thrust of it. Mark?
Yes, well, two points raised by what Charles was beginning to say. First, it's extraordinarily important for liberal democratic society that our government be protected from the nepotistic principles that are a signal of political corruption, so that there are all kinds of rules that we have in place, laws, that prevent the undermining of American government, whether it's local or state or national, by essentially clan-like principles. Charles mentioned also, if I understand the thrust of his point, mentioned also his admiration for the Pashtun of Afghanistan, who live very close to the land, and Charles mentioned that he really admires the family, and to which I say amen, absolutely, but with an important caveat. So the rule of the clan exercises a very powerful hold on the modern liberal imagination. And there are all kinds of films and books and television shows that valorize, that romanticize the rule of the clan and the social solidarity of that tight-knit extended family group. Think of, say, a movie like Avatar by James Cameron.
Yes.
But in fact, that admiration for such societies is a cultural trace of a centuries-long historical transformation of our own society from the rule of the clan to the liberal rule of law. The rule of the clan, clan societies, do a lot of things really, really well, in that, in fact, they do a lot of things much better than modern liberal societies, especially the provision of social cohesion, psychological security, and social justice. But we wouldn't want to actually, as liberals dedicated to principles of individual freedom, we wouldn't want to actually live in those societies. We may admire a close-knit nuclear family, but less so a corporate extended family group that structures its society and your own individual autonomy on principles of group honor and shame.
Mm.
So how do we, within liberal societies, how do we develop and achieve the benefits that the rule of the clan provides so well, and yet remain centrally committed to principles of individual autonomy? I think that's a great challenge. One way we do so is through the kind of cultural life and life of the imagination that I mentioned.
Well, Mark, you've lived in and studied so many societies, older societies, modern societies. You pose an interesting question from what you just said. I'm wondering if there is a society that really practices what you've been talking about in which you would really like to live or have lived.
Oh, well, I like the United States very much as an American, and I think in general we do a rather good job in that we are dedicated to principles of individual freedom with threats to it, as I've mentioned, but we offer a very robust civil society that enables individuals to achieve the benefits of social solidarity through voluntary group membership rather than through the ascriptive group membership in extended family groups or clans. So I think in the United States, as much as our own individual freedom can be threatened by various postmodern clans, we're on the right track, and it's essential that we remain on the right track so that we can make common cause with liberals around the world who are seeking to engage in their own particular social and political development within their own societies.
Charles, thanks for your call. I'm sorry your phone cut out. Daniel in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Daniel.
Are there examples in history where the conquering empire established the rule of law over the tribes or clans? Did the Roman Empire, for example, and do the clans ultimately win?
Daniel, that's a great question. I think it is striking that you find precious few examples of a society that has transformed out of the rule of the clan through the imposition of military force from the outside. Why is that? It's because the imposition of military force from outside on clan structures tends simply to exacerbate inter-clan and inter-tribal violence. One reason or one thing that we might be able to learn from that history, which counsels utterly against the effort to impose social and political development in the way that Daniel suggests, is that political and legal development from the rule of the clan to the rule of law should happen not over and above clans and tribal structures, but rather in cooperation with them. And you see that happening in early Anglo-Saxon England and in early Islamic Arabia as well.
And where do you see that happening now?
Well, take, for instance, in modern Afghanistan, where traditional tribal councils were incorporated through the Loya Jirga into Afghan state development. I think this is a very interesting example. Or in contemporary South Sudan, where I think you'll see legal and political development rely in part on a looking to and a reliance on and a recuperation of many traditional customary legal principles. So I think that these societies are seeking to modernize in social, political, politically, and legally by working through clans and not against them, and certainly not through the imposition of military force.
Daniel, thanks for your call. We have time for probably one more call. Will in DeForest. Hi, Will.
Yes, thank you. Great program. Vietnam vet. And I've noticed what this country's been doing throughout history. I've read it. And we go all over the world maiming and killing people in the name of liberating people or our natural interests. And what's the difference between a clan and a government of corporations rather than a government of the people? And how can we the people, change this structure to make it a more peaceful world and a better world for all of us?
Well, I think that's a great question with which to end or approach the end of the program. First, thank you for your service. I would say that you've asked, what's the difference between a government that has been co-opted by corporate structures of the kind with which we've been concerned with this program, and a government of clanism that is co-opted by extended family groups and doles out favors and patronage on that basis? And I would say the difference is, in terms of the consequences for individual freedom, pretty slight. And that's why we have common cause to make with people in very different societies that are working to make government effective so that it truly vindicates a public interest that rises above whatever corporate or clan structure is predominant in the society, and so vindicates individual principles, principles of individualism. How do we do that? We develop neutral principles of expertise by which government can exercise its authority, and we become actively involved in civic and government affairs to make government better.
Hmm. What was there some event that got you interested in all of this? I mean, I find your book is just so interesting in where you went to write it.
Thanks.
I mean, you had to do so much. Was there some event in world history that got you rolling in all of this, or what was it?
You know, I thought a lot about when I was in Iceland. I really thought a whole lot about my students who were very far from home abroad in Afghanistan and Iraq. I thought about, I had a student, Omar was his name, fighting in Iraq with a miniature copy of our U.S. Constitution in his pocket. And I thought a lot about the encounter that these students who had studied constitutional law with me, that is a tradition of American legal and political thinking centered at the same time on effective central power and principles of individual liberty, in the encounter that they were having with a very, very different tradition. And I began to think about all the ways in which that very different tradition of organizing a society and its law, what it had to teach us.
Thank you so much for being with us. I know you've been preempted a couple times because of major events in this country, and I'm glad we finally had a chance to have you on the air. Thank you, Mark.
I am, too. It was a real pleasure to be on your show, Kathleen.
Thank you. Mark Wiener, our guest, The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show and to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Stay with us. We're going to cook next hour.